Welcome back to the podcast. My name is Jesse.
Hey guys, I'm Chase.
I'm Chris.
I'm Dan.
And I'm Gabby.
Today, we are going to be taking you through four different TED Talks that we've researched, and each one of us will summarize the TED Talk we focused in on. We'll then open up the floor for discussion to further understand how these four speeches correlate and what lessons we can take away from them. So, the TED Talk I focused on was by Dan Harris, called The Benefits of Not Being a Jerk to Yourself. Dan Harris was formerly an ABC News anchorman for 21 years. His life changed, however, when he had a panic attack live on air in 2004. It was at this point in his life that he realized he needed to work on finding better ways to manage his anxiety and depression. One of the practices that Harris began introducing into his daily routine was meditation. Curious to see if meditation made him a nicer person, Harris opted into a 360-degree rapport at work, where his family, coworkers, and employers all provided interviewers with detailed descriptions of how they viewed Harris. The results Harris received were less than ideal, the majority painting him in a negative and angry light. Frustrated yet determined to improve, Harris later found himself on a 9-day wellness retreat. It was there that he learned the practice of loving-kindness meditation, the practice which is the main focus of his TED Talk. This form of meditation is centered around increasing one's capacity for warmth, both towards themselves and towards others. A cycle of constant self-criticism can make an individual miserable and resentful. Through loving-kindness meditation, this cycle can be stopped. The kinder you are to yourself, the kinder you will be in your relationships with others. Self-love is crucial to loving other people. When you increase your capacity to love yourself, you simultaneously increase your capacity to love others. Does anybody have any questions?
Yeah, I do. I have a question. I got a question for you right here, Jessica. I was wondering, what is the constant self-criticism? Why is constant self-criticism so dangerous?
That's a great question, Chase. So constant self-criticism is incredibly dangerous, specifically for our relationships with others. When you are constantly criticizing yourself, you feel miserable, and you start to take it out on others. You then feel even more miserable since you know you're not treating your relationships correctly, so you self-criticize again and the cycle continues. Harris describes this phenomenon as the toilet vortex.
Okay, I have a question too. So what are some practical steps that we can take to shift from being overly self-critical to practicing self-compassion in our daily lives, especially during challenging moments?
Yeah, so if you ever find yourself being especially self-critical, this would be a great time to practice loving-kindness meditation. So to do so, you need to start by finding a quiet place and getting into a comfortable position. Start by envisioning an easy person or someone you enjoy being around. Harris mentioned like a pet or a family member. Repeat in your head four phrases. May you be happy, may you be healthy, may you be safe, and may you live with ease. Then move on to yourself, then a mentor, then a neutral person, then a difficult person, and then finish with all beings everywhere. Harris explained that implementing this meditation routine into his daily life truly helped him gain more compassion for himself.
I also have a question. How can increasing your own capacity to love yourself impact the lives of those around you?
Yeah, good question. So when you increase your own capacity to love, a journey Harris calls the cheesy upward spiral commences. So as you start to love yourself more, your increased inner happiness will begin showing up in your relationships with other people. Humans need to feel happy and secure in their relationships in order to flourish. So when this need is met, your capacity to love yourself will grow further still. The more kindness you have for yourself, the more kindness you will have for other people.
That's an amazing answer. Okay, so we can round it out with my question. My question is, in what ways can mindfulness and meditation help us become more aware of our inner critic?
Yeah, great question. So it was through meditation that Dan Harris himself was actually able to come to terms with his own inner critic. So, as I mentioned, he went on a 9-day silent retreat, and it was on the 6th day that he finally realized how exhausted he was, constantly fighting with the voices in his own head. He realized that these demons, or the personality traits that he was trying so desperately to change, were just fear-based programs passed down to him through his parents and through his culture. These programs were just trying to help him. It is difficult to look at and accept your demons, but once you do, they don't own you as much. Once you accept yourself for who you are, you can start accepting others.
Thank you, Jesse. It seems like we can learn a lot from errors and struggles. So now we're going to move on to mine and Gabby's TED Talk, which is about how to make stress your friend. So in Kelly's TED Talk, How to Make Stress Your Friend, she discusses a study that fundamentally changed her perspective on stress. The first study she mentions tracked 30,000 adults in the United States over 8 years. Researchers asked participants how much stress they had experienced in the past year and whether they believed that stress was harmful to their health. They then looked at public death records to find out who died. The results were surprising. People who experienced a lot of stress had a 43% chance of risk of dying, but this was only true for those who also believed that stress was harmful. On the other hand, people who experienced high stress but did not believe stress was harmful had the lowest risk of dying, even lower than those who reported experiencing very little stress. Using the study to highlight the power of mindset suggests that it's not the stress itself, but the belief that stress is harmful that can impact one's health. This insight shifted her view from seeing stress as the enemy to understanding that embracing stress in a positive way can actually be beneficial. Now I'm going to pass it to Gabby.
Thank you so much, Krish. So I looked at the little neuroscience lesson that Kelly did in the TED Talk, and the speaker talked about the neurohormone oxytocin, or it's more commonly known as the cuddle hormone in society. This hormone, she explains, fine-tunes social instincts and motivates people to build relationships and also increase their empathy. This makes them more willing to support people they care about. Oxytocin is also seen as a stress hormone, so that means it gets produced in a stress response, motivating people to seek support and to not bottle feelings or anything else like that up in their body. The hormone physically affects the body too, which Kelly explains, and it protects your cardiovascular system from stress because it causes vessels to relax and it also helps heart cells heal from stress damage. Overall, it shows that the body has a built-in stress response and stress resilience, and the prominent mechanism of this revolves around human connection, which was an insane insight from this TED Talk. So I'll open it up for any questions the group may have.
Yeah, so I have a question. So based on the TED Talk that you watched, how would you say that we can transform stress into a positive?
That's an amazing question. So Kelly did talk about that she made stress the enemy when she was talking to people about it. But then she finally understood that not just stress negatively affects your body, but it's also the view that stress is bad that affects your body. She advocated for stress being the enemy and trying to fix that. But society has the view that stress can be negative on someone's body, but the reality is that you have a higher risk of dying if you have that negative mindset, so changing that mindset is crucial.
Moving on, I have a similar question. So how, according to the TED Talk, how is someone affected by a traumatic event and high stress?
Yeah, so Kelly actually did talk about this, that financial difficulties and family crises that they may experience, which can be a traumatic event or high stress in someone's life, can increase the risk of dying by 30%. However, this wasn't true for every single person in this study because those who care and help others around them, relating back to the point of human connection, affects that stress response. So it does show that if you do have those human connections in your life and you are making connections with those around you, it does decrease the risk of you dying from those very traumatic events or high stress someone may experience in their life.
Awesome. So based on everything you guys have said, practically speaking, how do we use stress for our advantage in our day-to-day lives?
Yeah, great question. So stress prepares you for a challenge ahead. So if there's a big event coming up or something that throws a wrench in your plan, you notice the response of a heavy chest or beating heart and understand that that response is preparing you to tackle the challenge and overcome it. We have all had an issue where there's a test or a presentation coming up and your body has overcame with anxiety, but you have to change your mindset of that reaction just to get your body ready to navigate the situation and help you make amends with stress.
Yeah, Dan. So how do you view stress? And do you think it would be an easy change of mind?
I view stress as a complex but natural part of life. Stress can be powerful motivator that pushes people to grow, perform and adapt, but it can also become overwhelming and harmful if not managed properly. The way you perceive and respond to stress can play a significant role in its impact on your well-being. I feel like it is not the easiest thing to change your mindset, but as seen in the TED Talk, it is for sure possible. We are programmed to think about stress in a negative way, and if you're thinking about stress like that for a long time, it can be difficult to switch your mindset.
So now moving on, we're going to talk about a TED Talk that I watched. So the name of that talk is "We Still Have Too Few Women in Leadership, Now What?" by Laurie McGraw. So in her TED Talk, McGraw starts off by sharing a story about how her fifth grade teacher told her that girls don't do as well at learning about engines in an engines class. She said that proving her teacher wrong and getting an A taught her early on that girls can do anything. And in her perspective, women today feel like she once did, 24/7 in their workday, consistently having to prove themselves to other people in the workplace. She then talks about how even today, we don't develop enough women leaders, considering women get the most college degrees, and only a tiny number of women become CEO and top executives moving on in their career. However, this is a problem. This problem got even worse during COVID, with lots of women leaving their jobs or even thinking about quitting because of external issues. McGraw says that there are three big things that women need to fix and have helped to getting fixed in order to improve this situation. First is to have more confidence, since women won't apply for jobs unless they're 100% qualified, while men apply at 60%, according to her research. Learning to actually ask for what they want, like raising and promotions, and getting more mentors to help them guide in their careers is actually a crucial thing that she mentions in her TED Talk. She wraps up by saying that since women are half the world's population, we're wasting a lot of talent by not having enough more women leaders. She thinks if we work on these three things, confidence, asking for what we want, and mentorship, women can get into more leadership roles moving on into the future.
Thank you so much, Dan. That actually sounds very interesting. So I actually have a question, and the question is, was there a big event that caused the number of leadership positions to have a setback?
Of course, this problem is a systemic issue. It has been going on for a long time across the 21st and 20th century. However, the COVID-19 pandemic made things even worse. A lot of women had to step back from their jobs to take care of children, older relatives, or even manage homeschooling in general. This slowed down their career progress and made it difficult to continue moving towards leadership positions in and out of work. So while it wasn't one single event that helped to become such a worrying issue, the pandemic definitely amplified the existing challenges for women in the workplace.
Thank you. I also have another question. So what challenges do women leaders usually face that are different to men? And how do they overcome them to promote a healthy and more conscious workplace?
So women often deal with unique challenges that men don't face as much in leadership roles. For example, first, there's a problem with unconscious bias, gender bias, to be more exact. People might assume that men are better leaders than women, and women should be in more supportive roles in general. Women also don't always have the same access to mentors and sponsors who can guide them and open doors to new opportunities in their workplace. Also, making sure everyone, especially those who might not be able to speak up, have a chance to be heard is very, very important in this situation.
So, Dan, what was Ms. McGraw's suggestion for steps that should be taken for moving forward?
So she suggested a few steps that should be taken moving forward. One of the big things that she advocates is for structured mentorship and sponsorship programs inside companies. These programs can connect women with experienced leaders who can offer advice, help them navigate their careers, and give them access to leadership opportunities that might not be available otherwise. This support can make a huge difference in helping women overcome the barriers they face. She also emphasizes the need for organizations to address unconscious bias through training. This means helping people recognize these biases, like assuming men are more suited for leadership and changing those mindsets in an effective way. McGraw also believes that it's important to hold companies accountable for their diversity efforts, meaning that they actually need to follow through on their promise to promote the diversity in leadership and not just talk about it.
That's awesome, Dan. So based on everything you heard from McGraw, how do you think a good mentor might impact a developing leader?
So a mentor can have a huge impact on how someone was developed throughout their career and want to develop their leadership skills. They can offer guidance and advice on how to navigate tricky situations at work or make smart career moves or even help in projects. Having someone to talk through these challenges or bounce off ideas that can give a young leader the confidence to make decisions and take the risk they might not have taken otherwise, it's very important. A mentor can also act as an advocate for their mentee within the organization. They can have the mentee get noticed by higher-ups or recommended for important projects or even promotions. On top of that, mentors can introduce their mentees to new people, help them build a professional network, which can lead to even more opportunities moving forward. All of this helps the developed leader grow faster and more effectively in today's changing workplace.
Hey, what's up, guys? I'm Chase, and today we will be reflecting on Dan Gilbert's podcast, The Surprising Science of Happiness. Dan Gilbert is a psychology professor at the University of Harvard, and I'd like to explore his three main ideas from his TED Talk, which was impact bias, synthetic happiness, and how choices affect our satisfaction. The first major point that Dan Gilbert mentions is impact bias. This is the tendency to overestimate how much a future event will affect our emotions. So, Gabby, I have a question for you.
Yes, of course.
If you won the lottery today, how long do you think that happiness would last for?
Ooh, I honestly think I would be happy for a very long time, probably until the end of my life.
Fair enough. Now, Dan, let's say you just found out you failed your midterm. How long do you think that sadness would last for?
I think it would last for a long time, too.
Well, research shows that we're all pretty bad at predicting how long these emotions will last. Sure, winning the lottery would make us happy for a while, but over time, the happiness fades. And guess what? Same goes for that bad grade, Dan. What seems like a disaster in the moment actually doesn't impact us as much, or for as long as we think, whether they're positive or negative. So the next time you're stressed about something going wrong or waiting for that one thing to make you happy, remember that your brain might just be playing a trick on you. The second idea I'd like to talk about is synthetic happiness. This is one of my favorite concepts because this part of the TED Talk kind of changed the way I approach happiness myself. In his TED Talk, Dan Gilbert talked about two different types of happiness. What we call normal happiness, which is what happens when we get what we want, and synthetic happiness, which is what happens when we get what we don't want. Sounds obvious, right? But here's the kicker. Synthetic happiness is just as real and actually lasts just as long as the normal happiness is when we feel like we get what we want. It's the brain's way of adapting and making the best of the situation. So when things don't go as planned, we can still find genuine happiness. It's a comforting thought because it means we have the ability to be happy no matter what. So what does this mean? Well, for me, it means I don't really need to constantly chase after perfection to be happy. In fact, we can just create happiness even when things don't go our way. We have a lot more control over our feelings than we actually think we do. And lastly, let's talk about choices. We've all heard the more the merrier, right? Well, when it comes to making decisions, Dan Gilbert actually believes that having fewer choices can lead to greater satisfaction. Research shows that when we have too much options, we tend to feel less happy with our decision. This is because with more choices comes more pressure to pick the right one, and we often end up regretting or second-guessing ourselves. In his TED Talk, Dan talked about how he ran an experiment where he had students do a project, and he gave the students two choices. A, you can either choose a topic, and you have up to 4 days to change your mind, or you choose your topic one time, and once you choose, you'll never get to choose again. Surprisingly, 66% of his students chose the reversible option. So as humans, we want more options. We want more options, but in the long run, it decreases our happiness.
I have a question. How does our psychological immune system let us feel happy even when we don't get our way?
So for those who don't know, a psychological immune system is a concept developed by Dan Gilbert himself, which helps us feel happy even when things don't go as planned by enabling us to adapt to adverse situations or reinterpret them in a more positive way. Two ways I believe the psychological immune system can keep us happy is, for one, cognitive reframing. which is faced with disappointment. When we are faced with disappointment or failure, our psychological immune system can just help us shift our perspective. And lastly, our emotional adaptation. Over time, we adapt emotionally to new circumstances, even when we initially perceive them as negative. This means that while something like a breakup or a job loss may cause distress initially, our emotional response diminishes, and we find ways to feel content with our new reality.
Hey, I also have a question. I was wondering, do you agree with Gilbert's argument that happiness is something we can create internally, regardless of external circumstances? And could you just elaborate why or why not?
Yeah, so before this TED Talk, I wouldn't have agreed, but after, I definitely agreed. And the biggest reason is because of our psychological adaptations. Jessica, humans are the most incredibly adaptable and adaptable mammals in the world. And research supports that the idea that we often bounce back from adverse situations more quickly than we expect. For example, after winning the lottery or experience a traumatic midterm event, people tend to return to the same baseline of happiness regardless. And as Gilbert highlights, our ability to reinterpret negative experience plays a crucial role in how we perceive our happiness. This cognitive flexibility allows us to find meaning or positivity in situations we can't control.
Wow, Gilbert did give us a lot of insights, and I'm definitely going to be using this in my own life. So I actually have a question too. Gilbert suggested that fewer choices can lead to greater satisfaction. How might this concept apply to decision-making in everyday life?
Wow, that's a really good question.
Thank you so much.
Gilbert's suggestion that fewer choices can lead to greater satisfaction is rooted in the idea of having too much options can lead to choice overload, causing stress, indecisions, and dissatisfaction. In everyday life, this concept can apply to several decision-making situations. For instance, in dating or social networking, an excess of choices can lead to dissatisfaction because people may constantly question whether someone's better for them out there. By focusing on fewer and meaningful connections, rather than endless options, people can build deeper, more fulfilling relationships and avoiding the tendency to second guess other humans. In another situation, which is a lot more simpler, I feel like, is even when we go shopping and we're faced with numerous shopping options, like choosing between dozens of similar clothing or electronics, people often feel overwhelmed. And sometimes having fewer options simplifies the decision-making process and reduces anxiety of making the wrong choice.
Thank you guys all so much for sharing with the TED Talks you watched. We're honestly so lucky that we live in a time when we have access to these powerful speeches that can help us literally change our lives. This easy access can make it hard to sift through all this content, so I think it would be beneficial to our listener if we went through and summarized some common themes we saw across these TED Talks and the main takeaways that we can see ourselves actually implementing into our own lives.
So one of the big takeaways, at least from my side, is that it's extremely important to look inward before managing others, and that directly relates to our interpersonal relations class that we're taking currently. If it's either stress or happiness or battling with your own demons, it is really important to look inward and navigate those before moving externally to manage other people.
We had a few speakers use humor in their TED Talks. So this communication method was effective in engaging the audience along with making the messages lighter so information could be absorbed easier.
Reinforcing the theme of our course, so it was important to know how important interpersonal relationships, relationship management, and emotional intelligence are in the modern, ever-changing, and diverse workplace. Continuing to nurture a healthy and sustainable work setting using confidence, gentle humor, and meaningful mentorship and relationship building is the way to go for the future and the future companies.
Wow, thank you all so much for sharing. This sounds like a true testament to just how impactful these TED Talks really are. I hope our listener is also able to take away some of the key messages presented in this podcast and hopefully use them to maintain the relationships in their own life, especially with themselves. Thank you for listening. See you next time.